book on the need for a federal liability law protecting workers, begging him to read what it had to say about two higher court rulings inimical to bakers and tenement house cigar makers in New York. If the spirit which lies behind these two decisions obtained in all the actions of the federal and state courts, we should not only have a revolution, but it would be absolutely necessary to have a revolution, because the condition of the worker would become intolerable. Justice Day, who had concurred with the majority opinion of Justice White, was not able to do much more than note the title of the little volume Roosevelt found so alarming, Moral Overstrain. In the 3 weeks that followed, the President gave evidence of suffering from that condition himself. He became incensed by Congress's obvious reluctance to act on his last message, which included demands for inheritance and income taxes, national incorporation of interstate businesses, greater federal power over railroad rates, compulsory investigation of major labor disputes, wider application of the 8-hour day, and no fewer than 4 new battleships. Not unconnectedly, he also viewed with concern 2 looming threats to the presidential candidacy of William Howard Taft. First, Senator Foraker had made his own candidacy official and had called upon the Ohio GOP to choose between its 2 sons well in advance of the national convention, set for Chicago on 16 June. And in New York, the successful and popular governor Charles Evans Hughes was showing strength as a national candidate as well. Roosevelt had tried to help Taft by repeating, forcefully and unequivocally, that he himself would not run for a 3rd term. This had at least allayed lingering doubts about his determination to retire. But how to eliminate Hughes, whom he had backed strongly only 14 months before? He was quite willing to act, if he could do so without seeming treacherous. The governor was intelligent but humorless, and exuded such an aura of scraggy-bearded self-righteousness that Roosevelt had taken to calling him Charles the Baptist. An announcement that Hughes was to speak on national issues at the New York Republican Club on 31 January, in a clear bid for party attention, enabled the American people to observe, yet again, that Theodore Roosevelt was the most adroit tactician in American politics. Working at top speed, he wrote a special message to Congress, radical enough to excite the admiration of Upton Sinclair, and released it on the day of Hughes's speech. Its first words deceptively suggested that it was a response to the Supreme Court's anti-labor ruling, but its later paragraphs, filling 12.5 columns of dense print in Congressional Record, amounted to a rewrite, in much harsher language, of his neglected message of 2 months before. As a result, he simultaneously wrested from Hughes all the lead headlines, "Hottest message ever sent to Congress," put both court and Congress on the defensive, dulled Morgan's Savior of Society shine, and by the sheer audacity of his proposals made the progressive-conservative split in the Republican Party permanent, with himself, ambiguous no longer, aligned firmly on the left. He demanded that the employer's liability law be reenacted in a form that would satisfy the Supreme Court, yet apply even more strongly to interstate commerce. He declared that congressional unwillingness to write any remedial entitlements for job injuries into the so-called federal workers' compensation law was an outrage and humiliation to the United States. In no other prominent industrial country in the world could such gross injustice occur. Exactly as the working man is entitled to his wages, so he should be entitled to indemnity for the injuries sustained in the natural course of his labor. Ultimately, private employers should be compelled to apply federal principles of liability and compensation across the entire industrial landscape. Roosevelt proudly cited the Anthracite Coal Commission's 1903 strike report as a chart for action against the abuse of court injunctions in strikes and walkouts. Ultra-conservatives who object to cutting out the abuses will do well to remember that if the popular feeling does become strong, many of those upon whom they rely to defend them will be the first to turn against them. The Interstate Commerce Commission's powers should be extended to total financial supervision of railroads, and also physical control of interstate operations and the scheduling of deliveries of perishable products. It was the inadequacy of the Hepburn Act not its introduction in 1906, that had created an element of uncertainty in railroad stock speculations and contributed much to the financial stress of the recent past. Lastly, the Sherman Act should be refocused to distinguish between beneficial combinations and huge combinations which are both noxious and illegal. Referring to himself, not infrequently in the royal plural, Roosevelt admitted that he was engaged in a campaign against privilege that was fundamentally an ethical movement. His targets were stock gamblers, making large sales of what men do not possess, writers who act as the representatives of predatory wealth, among them probably the entire editorial staff of the New York Sun, and men of wealth who find in the purchased politician the most efficient instrument of corruption. He reserved his strongest language for these multimillionaires, not identifying them directly, but taking care to repeat with incantatory frequency the names of John D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company and E.H. Harriman's Santa Fe Railroad. Such men were the most dangerous members of the criminal class, the criminals of great wealth. Americans upon whom such men preyed had three choices: to let them flourish without supervision, to control them at the state level, or to regulate them by federal action. He did not doubt that the last option was the only way, as common law no longer had power to deal with uncommon wealth. These new conditions make it necessary to shackle cunning, as in the past we have shackled force. The vast individual and corporate fortunes, the vast combinations of capital which have marked the development of our industrial system, create new conditions and necessitate a change from the old attitude of the state and the nation toward the rules regulating the acquisition and untrammeled business use of property. Subscribers to the theory that Roosevelt was crazy found in his special message all the evidence they wanted. Chancellor James Roscoe Day of Syracuse University remarked that much of it reads like the ravings of a disordered mind. The New York Times and the New York Evening Mail both spoke of the president's tendency toward delusion, especially with regard to imaginary conspiracies against him, and the New York Sun said that his portentous diatribe might be referred better to psychologists than to the archivists of Congress. It is an even more disturbing reflection that the hand which penned this message is the same hand which directs the American Navy, now on its mission toward unknown possibilities. God send our ships, and all of us, good luck. Charles Lanier, of Winslow Lanier and Company, added drugs to the derangement theory. He claimed, in a rumor that tickled Roosevelt enormously, that the president is crazy, and furthermore indulging immoderately in drink, and is an opium fiend. Current literature, in one of its regular roundups of public opinion, noted the curious fact that almost all the questions about Roosevelt's mental health were being asked loudly and querulously in his home state. Calmer voices there were few, and none so salutary as that of a progressive judge, William J. Gaynor of Brooklyn. Every purse-proud individual, as well as reactionary dullard, always considers a great character insane. In their littleness of heart, of soul, he seems so to them, but the people know that Frederick the Great was not insane, although he was called so all over Europe, just as well as they know and understand Theodore Roosevelt. Gaynor's words were borne out by the echo-like promptness and fidelity of the response of Roosevelt Republicans west of the Hudson. The Philadelphia North American placed the special message in the forefront among the really memorable state papers in the history of the nation, and the Chicago Evening Post found it a profoundly conservative document in its insistence upon basic moral liberties. In remarkable harmony, a chorus of Southern Democratic newspapers praised the president's attack on his own old guard, and the Baltimore Sun seemed quite serious in proposing that he run for re-election as a Democrat, with William Jennings Bryan as his vice presidential candidate. Bryan himself, improbably resurgent after the defeat of Alton B. Parker, had gracious things to say. "It is a brave message, and needed at this time. All friends of reform have reason to rejoice that the President has used his high position to call attention to the wrongs that need to be remedied." All friends of Roosevelt were not, however, friends of reform, as he discovered when he received a letter from Nicholas Murray Butler early in February. More than 6 years had passed since Butler had sat listening to the accidental president ruminate in Commander Coles's parlor, years in which Butler's own self-discovery as president of Columbia University had hardened into chronic self-importance. "Of all your real friends, perhaps I alone am fond enough of you to tell you what a painful impression has been made on the public mind by your special message. Surely the sorry record of Andrew Johnson is sufficient proof that a president, whether right or wrong, cannot afford to argue with his adversaries after the fashion of a private citizen, other than in a state paper or in a formal public address. If you will read this message over quietly, and then read any of the most important presidential messages which have preceded it, you will yourself see exactly what I mean. You will see how lacking it is in the dignity, in the restraint, and in the freedom from epithet which ought to characterize so important a state paper. My honest opinion is that so far as the message has had any purely political effect, it is to bring Mr. Bryan measurably nearer the White House than he has ever been before." Roosevelt declined to accept Butler's censure. "You regret what I have done. To me, your regret is incomprehensible." On 7 February, the Great White Fleet, dispatched toward unknown possibilities by an allegedly deranged, William James preferred the term, dynamogenic, commander-in-chief, entered the Strait of Magellan. Since leaving Hampton Roads, it had become a diplomatic phenomenon, attracting worldwide press attention and spreading as much goodwill as foam along the Brazilian and Argentine coastlines. Even Punta Arenas, Chile, a windswept wooden iron outpost near the extreme tip of the continent, welcomed Admiral Evans and his sailors with elaborate hospitality and specially hiked prices. For 22 hours, the Chilean destroyer Chacabuco led Evans's flagship Connecticut through the misty strait, a surreal doppelganger of the waterway being carved across Panama, while 15 other coal-heavy ships wallowed behind at 400-yard intervals. No more than 3 men of war had ever performed this maneuver in convoy, and the going was hazardous, even for single units, but the fleet steamed steadily through. It veered off course only once, when a sudden turbulence proclaimed the conflicting levels of two oceans. By the time the last vessel emerged into open sea, the first was already steaming toward Valparaiso, and the Pacific Theater had received its largest ever infusion of battleships. Roosevelt had still not announced his intention to send the fleet around the world. Its official destination remained San Francisco. But Japan was aware that another war scare in the United States could quickly alter the fleet's course. Admiral Dewey's 90-day lag no longer applied. This knowledge, combined with mounting diplomatic pressure from Elihu Root, now forced the conclusion of the gentleman's agreement on which Tokyo had been politely stalling for nearly a year. Throughout 1907, the influx of Japanese coolies into the United States had continued to pour unabated, making a mockery of the new immigration law. Root had tired of pointing out that the flow had to be restricted at its source, as per Tokyo's verbal promise. Instead, he had taken advantage of the publicity attending the dispatch of the Great White Fleet to warn Ambassador Aoki that unless there was a very speedy change in the course of immigration, the 60th Congress was certain to pass an exclusion act, greatly to the detriment of Japanese-American relations. By 29 February, as the fleet headed north from Callao, Peru, the gentlemen's agreement was finally implemented. Coolies were no longer permitted to immigrate to Hawaii, passport restrictions were tightened, and illegal agencies were being prosecuted by Japanese authorities. And at last, the monthly Yellow Peril Index, compiled by the State Department, began to decline. Roosevelt celebrated by confirming that the Great White Fleet, now en route to the Golden Gate, would proceed around the world. After a couple of months' rest and refitting, its itinerary would include Hawaii, New Zealand, Australia, the Philippines, Japan, about 2 weeks before the presidential election, China, Ceylon, the Suez Canal, Egypt, the Mediterranean, and Gibraltar. Its due date for return to Hampton Roads was 22 February 1909, 10 days before he was to leave the White House. Pulverizing as the president's special message had been to the boomlet for Governor Hughes, and however revealing of Roosevelt's own changing ideology, it merely increased the opposition of congressional conservatives against him. Joseph Cannon in the House and Nelson Aldrich in the Senate vied with each other to deny him the reforms he had begged with such eloquence. However, a small band of progressive Republicans and a larger one of moderate Democrats, who had applauded repeatedly during the reading of the message, helped him win at least 3 new laws: a reenacted Federal Employers Liability Act, the Workmen's Compensation Act for federal employees, and the Child Labor Act for the District of Columbia. He also won, on 10 March, a non-legislative victory with fruits that tasted distinctly sour. The Senate Committee on Military Affairs concluded its 13-month investigation of the Brownsville affair and found, by 9 votes to 4, that Roosevelt had justifiably dismissed without honor the soldiers of the 25th Infantry. 3,000 pages of testimony and the congruent opinions of virtually all Army authorities from the Commander-in-Chief on down were enough to convince 5 Democrats and 4 Republicans that the men were guilty. The dissenting members were all Republican, but they were themselves divided in a way that paradoxically compromised the majority vote. 2 found the testimony to be contradictory and untrustworthy, reflecting irreconcilable antipathies between soldiers and townspeople. Senators Foraker and Morgan J. Bulkley insisted that the weight of the testimony showed the soldiers to be innocent. So did the weight of the only hard evidence in the case, 33 spent Army-issue cartridges found at the scene of the crime. Ballistics experts had testified that, while the shells had definitely been fired by Springfield rifles belonging to the 25th, the actual firing had occurred during target practice at Fort Niobrara in Nebraska, long before the battalion was ordered to Texas. The mystery of the translocation of the shells to Brownsville was simply explained. Army budget officers frowned on waste of rechargeable ordnance, so 1,500 shells had been recovered from the range, sent south, and stored in an open box on the porch of a barracks hut at Fort Brown, available for any soldier or passing civilian to help himself. Such technical information, however, could not explain away the wooden, stolid look that Inspector General Garlington had seen on the faces he interviewed. It was a look so evocative of Negro complicity that the War Department had briskly dispensed with the formality of allowing every soldier his day in court. Roosevelt's other major legislative request, unsatisfied through the first weeks of spring, was for 4 new battleships. The House followed the recommendation of its Committee on Naval Affairs and appropriated funds for only 2. Unappeased by an extra appropriation to build a naval base at Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt put his hopes in the Senate. Debate there began on 24 April, none too favorably. Senators seemed more inclined to question the legality of his battle fleet cruise order than to double the battleship quota of the House bill. But they also had to take into account his still phenomenal popularity and the hold the Great White Fleet had taken of the public imagination. 3 days later, Roosevelt won a modified victory: 2 battleships, plus a guarantee that 2 more would be funded before he left office. Sounding rather like a small boy, he claimed not to have expected 4 all at once, but had asked for them only because he wanted to be sure of getting 2. Roosevelt's endorsement of the recommendation of the Inland Waterways Commission was not unallied with his own profound enjoyment of anything rocky, slimy, hardscrabble, and dangerous. In Washington, he had become a confirmed river rat, frequently cruising down the Potomac or up the Anacostia in the Sylph, and hiking, wading, and climbing for miles along the wild banks of Rock Creek. Invitations to accompany him on what he was pleased to call walks usually bore the cautionary superscript, put on your worst clothes. This gave notice that, sooner or later, he and his companions would end up in water, irrespective of whether it was freezing, mud-choked, or dangerously turbulent. "But, Mr. President," Jules Josserand was reduced to saying, "I have no worst clothes left." Roosevelt was so much at home in the creek that he often walked straight across it, absorbed in conversation, not seeming to notice the water around his hips, even when he was jostling ice floes. He was impervious to cold, and when necessary would start swimming, while his companions succumbed to cramps. "To succeed in such cases," one of his former Rough Riders advised Josserand, "you must have a good layer of fat under your skin." The little ambassador was not well padded, but he was as tough as an Alpine montagnard, and had become Roosevelt's favorite exercise partner. He even accompanied the president on an excursion across a Potomac water pipe, so high and slimy that they were forced eventually to admit defeat. Roosevelt, who wanted to follow the pipe to its destination on a mid-river island, hailed a passing rowboat and asked to be ferried there. As the boat pushed out into the current, Roosevelt put his arm around Josserand's neck, struck an attitude, and intoned, "Washington and Rochambeau crossing the Delaware." Shortly after the battleship vote, in warm May weather, the president led Josserand, Assistant Secretary of State Robert Bacon, and three other hikers on a strenuous cliff-hanging expedition along the Virginia side of the Potomac near Chain Bridge. When all were pouring with perspiration, Roosevelt suggested a swim and stripped naked. His party followed suit, but Josserand absent-mindedly kept on his black kid climbing gloves. "Mr. Ambassador," Roosevelt called from the water's edge, "have you not forgotten something?" Josserand shouted back, "We might meet ladies." The river was still cold, and when the swimmers returned to shore, they were obliged to step wet into their clothes and pull their socks on over mud-plastered feet. A further rock climb was prescribed to restore body heat. Josserand admired the president's bear-like ascent of a cliff so precipitous that it defeated everyone else except the athletic Bacon. When finally they trooped back to their waiting carriages, the assistant secretary's trouser leg was slit from hip to ankle. On 12 May, 45 state and territorial executives dined at the White House on the eve of the governor's conference. They were joined by 30 other dignitaries and Roosevelt acolytes at a vast horseshoe table in the state dining room. The president sat with Chief Justice Fuller on his right and Speaker Cannon on his left, in a severe sulk at being downgraded. Elsewhere in the room, he could see members of what Owen Wister called his concert of familiars. Gifford Pinchot, hawk-nosed at the extreme south end of the shoe next to Frank McCoy, who had hauled down Old Glory in Havana 6 years before. John Mitchell of the United Mine Workers, dulled by drink. Justice Holmes, long since returned to presidential favor. Handsome James Garfield. Commander William Sims, the Navy reformer, even handsomer, and Justice Moody, clean-shaven now, with a strange aloofness settled upon him, the most interesting-looking man in the room. Faces less intimately familiar looked back at him from among the many anonymous governors. Andrew Carnegie and James J. Hill, millionaires. Captain Archibald Willingham de Graffenried Butt, his new Georgian military aide. Senator Newlands of Nevada, and William Jennings Bryan, probably the last person any social secretary would expect to see on the president's dinner list, with the exception of Booker T. Washington. Bryan's presence, and controversial placement next to Moody, signaled the democratic nature of tomorrow's conference on the conservation of natural resources. When wood and water were endangered, the political differences between men of power dissolved. To Roosevelt's regret, his only living predecessor, Grover Cleveland, was unable to attend because of illness. Many of the governors had never been in the White House before, and they were noticeably awed by the splendor of their reception. Roosevelt, wanting to stress the conference's momentousness, had ordered that they be presented to him as for a state dinner. He had welcomed them one by one in the East Room and led them down the great vestibule with Fuller walking alongside him, in a mimetic show of power and justice, guiding procedure. The dinner seating had been planned with further formality by the State Department, but Roosevelt, looking it over, had decided that enough was enough, and rearranged it so that men with things to say to each other, such as James J. Hill and Theodore E. Burton of the Inland Waterways Commission, could sit together, conferring, after all, being the whole point of conferences. To further aid the flow of talk, and sherry, sauterne, and claret, he elected to have no toasts or speeches. Gentlemen from the West, who tended to eat more than they spoke, were awarded full command of a menu including little-neck clams on the half-shell, coquille of fresh caviar, strained gumbo, cold salmon bayardere, squabs à l'estouffade, filet piqué Richelieu, ice cream praliné, fancy cakes, and coffee. Since the night was warm, cigars and liqueurs were served on the West Terrace. Roosevelt accepted neither, concentrating all his attention on Bryan. The two men talked at a small table for more than an hour. Captain Butt overheard the President saying, "I confess to you confidentially that I like my job." The rest of the company strolled and admired the fragrant garden. In spite of himself, Roosevelt was impressed by the commoner. "A wonderful man," he remarked afterward. At 11 o'clock the following morning, Roosevelt called to order a vastly larger assembly in the East Room. Present, along with the governors and their aides, were his entire cabinet, minus only Taft, who was in Panama, and Metcalf, who was with the fleet in San Francisco. All 9 justices of the Supreme Court, an uncounted number of members of Congress, representatives of 68 professional societies, including those of chemistry, law, medicine, publishing, social and political science, civil engineering, forestry, architecture, mining, scenic and historic preservation, statistics, drainage, farming, lumber, slack cooperage, and hay, 21 editors and reporters from technical, news, and popular publications, 48 special guests, including academics, geographers, entomologists, biologists, soil experts, and commissioners of labor and Indian affairs. In a major gesture toward universal representation, one seat was assigned to Sarah S. Platt Decker, president of the General Federation of Women's Clubs. Allowing for a few invitees not showing, and excluding a constant influx and egress of senators and congressmen, the governor's conference totaled some 360 persons. The syllabus, prepared for its guidance by W. J. McGee, intimidatingly comprised 95 aspects of conservation, preservation, and planned exploitation under 11 headings: mineral fuels, ores and related materials, soil, forests, sanitation, reclamation, land laws, grazing and stock raising, relations between rail and water transportation, navigation, power, and conservation as a national policy. "The Lord thy God bringeth thee into a good land," intoned old Edward Everett Hale, the chaplain of the Senate, "a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs, flowing forth in valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, and vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive trees and honey, a land wherein thou shalt eat bread without scarceness. Thou shalt not lack anything in it, a land where stones are iron, and out of whose hills thou mayest dig copper." Roosevelt delivered the opening address. "You have come hither at my request so that we may join together to consider the question of the conservation and use of the great fundamental sources of wealth of this nation. So vital is this question that for the first time in our history, the chief executive officers of the states separately and of the states together forming the nation have met to consider it. It is the chief material question that confronts us, second only and second always to the great fundamental questions of morality." Applause filled the room. 3 days of serious discussions were only just beginning, yet already Roosevelt and Dr. Hale had sounded the conference's keynote and pedal point, that the natural endowment was a gift of God, and that utilitarianism must be subject to human and spiritual constraints. Roosevelt remarked on the anomaly whereby man, as he progressed from savagery to civilization, used up more and more of the world's resources, yet in doing so tended to move to the city and lost his sense of dependence on nature. Lacking that, he also lost his foresight and unwittingly depleted the inheritances of his children. We cannot, when the nation becomes fully civilized and very rich, continue to be civilized and rich unless the nation shows more foresight than we are showing at this moment. Further applause, interrupted the president. In the elegantly printed little program every guest had been issued, his speech bore the title, Conservation as a National Duty. He reviewed the energy policy of the United States from the days of General Washington, when anthracite coal was known only as a useless black stone, and water was practically the only source of power outside human and animal exertion. Ignorant though Washington had been of the potentials of coal and steam, he had seen clearly that the future United States could be linked in perpetuity only by a common power network. To that end, the father of the country had pressed for and brought about an interstate waterways conference between Virginia and Maryland. It met, said Roosevelt, allowing his listeners to make what comparisons they chose, near where we are now meeting, in Alexandria, adjourned to Mount Vernon, and took up the consideration of interstate commerce by the only means then available, that of water. And the trouble we have since had with the railways has been mainly due to the fact that naturally our forefathers could not divine that the iron road would become the interstate and national highway, instead of the old route by water. Washington's conference had led to another, much greater one in Philadelphia, involving all the states, that was in its original conception merely a waterways conference, but when they had closed their deliberations, the outcome was the Constitution which made the states into a nation. Applause again surged, acting as a drum roll to his next thematic sentence. The Constitution of the United States thus grew in large part out of the necessity for united action in the wise use of our natural resources. He proceeded to catalog the irresponsibility with which Americans, over more than a century and a quarter, had successively abused water, mineral, and forest resources, leading to the loss of more than half the nation's original timber, and signs of exhaustion already visible in iron and coal reserves. The pristine waterway scheme of the Founding Fathers was now neglected, underused, and ill-managed. The soils of unexampled fertility that had greeted pioneer farmers were leaching away through ignorance, washed into the streams, polluting the rivers, denuding the fields, and obstructing navigation. Again he harped on the need for foresight, and again was applauded as his use of the word became rhythmic. We have to, as a nation, exercise foresight, and if we do not exercise that foresight, dark will be the future. It was the duty of the Governor's Conference, he said, to formulate a national philosophy of conservation based on efficient use of finite resources and scientific management of renewable ones. For himself, he vowed to continue working through the Inland Waterways Commission, which he took pride in having created. I had to prosecute the work by myself, and which, if Congress persisted in depriving it of funds, he would perpetuate by executive means. This won him his loudest ovation yet, hardly quieter than the one that followed his praise of Gifford Pinchot's initiative in making conservation a national priority. Then he won bursts of laughter by quoting a recent opinion by Justice Holmes, gazing at him from only a few feet away, in favor of the right of the state as quasi-sovereign to prevent private property owners from despoiling a waterway, even though there are benefits from a great river that might escape a lawyer's notice. I have simply quoted, Roosevelt said, as the audience guffawed. He concluded with another invocation of conservation as morality, and sat down amid cheers. Rules were announced for orderly conduct of the conference's discussion sessions, set to begin after lunch. Experts presenting overlong statements would be subjected to the discipline of bells. Governors would have chair powers. The proceedings of the conference would be recorded and published in full. A committee on resolutions should be organized and authorized to formulate general conclusions. The hands of the East Room clock now stood at 5 minutes past noon. Gentlemen, Roosevelt called out, I shall now have the pleasure of meeting you personally as you pass through the Blue Room." He stayed with them through Andrew Carnegie's postprandial paper on the conservation of ore. Then, having tried and failed to get William Jennings Bryan to speak extempore, he gracefully withdrew, explaining, "I have a good deal to do." A good deal of that good deal apparently demanded his presence on the White House tennis court, but he was conscientious thereafter in opening each session and hearing each opening paper. The conference broke up on the afternoon of 15 May after a garden party for attendees and their wives, hosted by Edith Roosevelt, and hastily relocated indoors when rain descended. The governors issued a concluding declaration that upheld everything the president had said about the interrelationship of civilization and conservation and morality, and morality and duty. They urged the continuation and extension of the administration's current forest and water policies, recommended the enactment of laws against wasteful practices in mines and heavy industry, and resoundingly agreed that "this conservation of our natural resources is a subject of transcendent importance, which should engage unremittingly the attention of the nation, the states, and the people in earnest cooperation." Thus empowered, Roosevelt promptly created a National Conservation Commission under the chairmanship of Gifford Pinchot, instructing it to compile the inventory he had called for at Memphis. He announced that he would also call a North American Conservation Conference to enlist the aid of Canada and Mexico in protecting the hemispheric environment. Ultimately, if not in his own presidency, then perhaps early in the next, there should be an international conference with an even larger agenda, spreading the philosophy of conservation worldwide. Americans began to be aware of the extent to which he, often by stealth over the past 6 years, had used his powers, Joseph Cannon would say, misused them, to set aside an extraordinary, large, and varied swath of the national commons. He had created 5 national parks, doubling the total bequeathed to him in 1901, and struggled against mining interests to make a 1/6 of the Grand Canyon. Unsuccessful in that quixotic task, he had made the canyon a national monument instead, under the new Antiquities Act, effectively preserving it for future parkhood. In fewer than 6 months since the passage of the Act, he had proclaimed 15 other national monuments, interpreting the latter word loosely to include environments as different as Muir Woods, California, and Gila Cliff Dwellings, New Mexico. He had initiated 20 federal irrigation projects in 14 states under the National Reclamation Act. He had declared 13 new national forests, a total that Pinchot intended to vastly multiply now that conservation was at last part of the American ethos. Perhaps nearest to Roosevelt's own heart, he had created 16 federal bird refuges, starting with Pelican Island, Florida, in an executive coup that was already part of his legend. "Is there any law that will prevent me from declaring Pelican Island a federal bird reservation? Very well, then I so declare it." At Wichita Forest, Oklahoma, he had made the first federal game preserve. His 3 environmental commissions on public lands, inland waterways, and national conservation had embarked on the probably ill-fated but historically important task of educating corporate skeptics to an awareness of the rape of the American wilderness. And Roosevelt had 9 months left in office to expand on these beginnings as relentlessly as he was able. 2 weeks later, Congress adjourned, with no last-minute legislative largesse thrown the president's way, and its members hastened to prepare for their respective national conventions. Roosevelt remained in Washington to monitor the last few days of Taft's campaign for the Republican nomination and quell yet another little flurry of rumors that he was hoping to be drafted for a 3rd term. "Any man who supposes that I have been scheming for it is not merely a fool, but shows himself to be a man of low morality," he wrote to Lyman Abbott. "He reflects upon himself, not upon me." In the midst of this protest, he could not help adding, "There has never been a moment when I could not have had practical unanimity without raising a finger." 2 West Virginia delegates, elected under instructions for Taft, actually announced that they were switching their votes to the president, Roosevelt was obliged to write a letter to their congressman, urging him to tell them how strongly he objected to any such pledge. He had the letter copied in case of any other defections, but doubted that he would have to use it. Taft, having managed to defeat Senator Foraker's attempt to co-opt the Ohio GOP, was now far ahead of the two other ranking candidates for the nomination, Governor Hughes and Senator Knox. Roosevelt assured Henry Adams that Will would get a two-thirds vote on the first ballot in Chicago. As for himself, he was now safe out of it. Adams had to admit, in the privacy of his own correspondence, that these words had struck a chill. For 20 years he had pretended to detest Roosevelt, joked and gossiped about him, and mocked his every supposedly thoughtless bull-calf blunder. But the mere thought of the president being, at last, out of it, was enough to make Adams realize that there would soon be none left of his old Washington salon, excepting Henry Cabot Lodge, who was as much a cold stone statue these days as any of the Capitol's growing population of sculpted statesmen. Whatever else might be said of Roosevelt, he had vigor de vita. "The old house will seem dull and sad," Adams wrote, "when my Theodore has gone." Chapter 31. The Residuary Legatee. Mr. Hennessy, I don't know whether the administration is a success or not. Mr. Dooley, me friends differ. Mr. Hennessy, Rosenfeld says it is. Mr. Dooley, Rockefeller says it isn't. Mr. Hennessy, but anyhow, whether 'tis a success or not, it's been enjoyable. The first day of June 1908 found Theodore Roosevelt alone in the White House, with only his youngest son for company. Edith and Ethel were cruising down the Potomac in search of sea breezes. Archie had transferred to Sagamore Hill, and his elder children were gone, or half gone, along their respective roads to independence. "Until Quentin goes to bed, the house is entirely lively," he wrote to Ted. "After that, the rooms seem big and lonely and full of echoes. The carpets and curtains are all away, as the heat of summer has begun." His office time was devoted largely to persuading as many still uncommitted delegates as possible to vote for Taft at the Republican National Convention, now little more than 2 weeks off. In doing so, he had to make fanatic Rooseveltians understand that he would not accept a draft himself on any size of silver plate, difficult for them to believe and depressing for him to reiterate, since the certainty that he would be elected if nominated was no less than of Quentin growing taller. Q, as schoolmates called him, was an always cheerful, straight-A student with a love of long words, chopping them up patriarchally and grinning when he succeeded without stuttering. "The Republican presidents have been most uniformly good, but the Democrats have been, without exception, terrible." Some of the words were misapplied or wholly invented. Q never let deliberation impede his eloquence. He was 10.5 years old now, and Roosevelt noticed, with some sadness, that he was no longer interested in being read to. The White House gang, an elite cadre of Washington's most subversive small boys, accepted Q as their leader, not because he was the son of the president, but because with his big head, cyclonic energy, and moral decisiveness, he simply was Theodore Roosevelt in their imitative world, just as placid, plump-cheeked Charles Taffy Taft, unquestioningly accepting Q's orders, acted as Secretary of War in all confrontations with foreign powers, notably the District of Columbia Police Department. As an honorary member of the gang, which operated out of the White House attic, the president was capable of considerable mischief himself. But when Q's guerrilla activities threatened national security, he did not hesitate to exercise his authority as commander-in-chief. One such occasion was the Battle of the Gaiden, waged on the South Lawn between two divisions of the gang, respectively led by Q and Taffy. The property office of the War Department having condemned a moth-eaten silk artillery pennant, Company Q decided to fight Company T for possession of it. Whichever side held the colors for 3 minutes, Q, like his father, was an obsessive clock-watcher, would win the privilege of dictating gang activities for the rest of the afternoon. Taffy, like his father, a capable deployer of military materiel. Stake the guidon about 5 feet from the nozzle of a hose, the strategic significance of which Q did not at first appreciate. During the ensuing battle, Taffy, by far the largest combatant, maintained his grasp on the flagstaff and ordered an aide, Edward Slat's steed, to spin a concealed tap. Q and his force of 3 men were blasted head over heels in the resultant gush of water. Enraged, Q issued a counter order. "Keep it up, keep it up. I'm going to sinister this immediately," and disappeared. Suddenly, the gush lost its force. As the spray cleared, Q was revealed in possession of a fire axe, with which he had sliced the hose into several sections. His triumph was forestalled by a stentorian shout from the West Wing, and the President came charging through the Rose Garden, coattails flying. T.R., panting heavily, too late, by George. Quentin, I mean Georgie Washington, come here with your incriminating hatchet. In the heat of battle, many acts which would not be countenanced at other times may be excusable, or at least subject to sympathetic interpretation. Of course you understand that, boys. Q. Sure. You mean that's the reason why I did it? I did it because something had to be done immediately. T.R. That's exactly it. The point is always to do something quickly, because if you don't, the other fellow will. Charles Evans Hughes, whose candidacy for the Republican presidential nomination had never recovered from Roosevelt's surprise attack in January, could vouch for this advice, along with Senator Foraker, Kaiser Wilhelm II, and President Marroquin of Colombia. But the president was not finished with his son. T.R. You may be wrong, you were here, but you have at least initiated action. When the action is wrong, you must admit it, and correct it by some further action. Q, looking at the severed hose, I don't see how this can be corrected. T.R., only by an entirely new garden hose. It was government property, still is, but also is no longer. You cannot imagine the difficulties involved and the things required to be done in order to replace it. It will even cost money, part of that which I am earning, or was earning, when interrupted by a dispatch regarding the progress of this war, and left hurriedly for the field. Q. Well, of course you're right, but we've learned our lesson, you know. T.R. We? Don't you mean yourself? And what have you learned? Q. Not to cut up garden hoses. T.R. And not to use fire axes on anything but a fire. Q. With a touch of wistfulness, we are not so likely to have a fire. T.R. Not with all this water around. You escape, Quentin, only because of the extenuating circumstances arising out of the heat of battle. With that, he turned on his heel and marched back to the executive office. To adults, as well as gang members, Q was a freakish duplication of his father, right down to the juvenile asthma and queer, prudish chivalry. When classmates giggled at a girl's upfolded dress, he yanked it down, trembling with anger. He had the same physical courage, clarity of perception, and ability to concentrate totally on the task at hand. Yet more than any of the other Roosevelt children, except Alice, who in any case had a different mother, he had a large personality of his own. Henry Adams found him fascinating, as had Mark Hanna. Q was imaginative enough to withdraw periodically into daydreams that seemed to elevate him in an almost physical sense. He loved heights and the eagle's eye perception that height endows. The famous Macmillan Commission models of Washington thrilled him. Look down on the White House as if you were a god. How small it looks. You could drop a pebble on it and crush it, together with the pygmy president and the State War Navy Department, too, by mistake. The last two words were an indication of Quentin Roosevelt's essentially kindly nature. Like his father, he had an aggressive urge to hurl bolts from above. Unlike his father, he thought about the consequences. To the rather less aggressive Kermit Roosevelt, the president wrote, "I have 2 first-rate maps of the part of Africa we are to go to." For some time, he had been thinking of taking Kermit, who had just graduated from Groton, on a hunting trip after William Howard Taft, or William Jennings Bryan, succeeded to the presidency, he knew himself well enough to know that he would want to reassume control of the government, if necessary at the head of a company of cavalry, within weeks of either man's inauguration. The stability of the country and of his own blood pressure might best be preserved if he withdrew to an environment as remote as possible from Washington. Newfoundland and Alaska had been presented as possibilities, but during the last few months, after a dinner with the African explorer Carl Akeley, Roosevelt had become obsessed with the idea of conducting a marathon 9-month safari through British East Africa and the uplands of the Nile. He had tried hard to pretend to Edith, when she came back from her cruise, that the trip was merely a pipe dream that could easily blow away, but to Kermit he gave a more concrete impression. "I think I shall get a double-barreled 450 cordite, but shall expect to use almost all the time my Springfield and my 4570 Winchester. I shall want you to have a first-class rifle, perhaps one of the powerful new model 40 or 45 caliber Winchesters. Then it may be that it would be a good thing to have a 12-bore shotgun that could be used with solid ball. It is no child's play going after lion, elephant, rhino, and buffalo." As he wrote, the Republican herd of delegates, now overwhelmingly pledged to Taft, began to converge like slow wildebeests on Chicago. "Roosevelt stampede stopped," ran a gratifying headline in the Washington Evening Star. The body copy, however, allowed that anything could still happen when they met head to head. "I know that the president does not want the nomination and will not accept it," Congressman Charles P. Landis of Indiana was quoted as saying. "Of course, if the convention should nominate him and then adjourn, he would have to take it." The ironic secret, which would have provoked the herd to a horizon-filling rout if carried on any breeze, was that Taft did not want the nomination either. As always, when strong people around him felt strongly, Roosevelt, Mrs. Taft, Charles P. Taft, even young Taffy, he went along. His heart alone protested. A few days before the convention, he said to Senator Cullum, "If your friend Chief Justice Fuller should retire and the president should send me a commission as Chief Justice, I would take it now." The hour was too late for such fantasies. At latest count, Taft had 563 delegates, Knox 68, and Hughes 54. One estimate of Taft's strength went even higher, to more than 600 delegates. There was no question as to whose popularity, whose policies, whose rhetoric, whose patronage, and whose mastery of press relations had pumped up this formidable total. Reluctant or not, Taft could hardly avoid being seen as the inevitable successor of an irresistible party leader. The giant airship that Count Ferdinand von Zeppelin was readying for flight at Friedrichshafen, Germany, was no more shaped, stressed, powered, and dirigible. Helen Taft's embarrassment about her husband's debt to the president was correspondingly acute. She wished he could be a candidate in his own right, and resented everything Roosevelt had done to help him, while dreading that her husband might yet suffer the indignity of having that support withdrawn. On Tuesday, 16 June, the convention opened at the Chicago Coliseum, where Theodore Roosevelt had been so triumphantly nominated 4 years before. Taft remained in Washington, headquartered in his office at the War Department, while the president worked in the West Wing, just a few dozen yards away. Both offices kept in constant telegraphic touch with floor managers in Chicago and with each other by telephone and messenger. At first, these communications were frequent, as a dispute about the use of injunctions in strike situations threatened the integrity of the party platform. But after Roosevelt and Taft agreed on a compromise plank, not at all to the satisfaction of the American Federation of Labor, the two power centers spoke less and less. Almost imperceptibly, a sense of separation began to develop between them. The proceedings in the Coliseum were routine through Wednesday afternoon, when Henry Cabot Lodge, speaking as permanent chairman, described Theodore Roosevelt as "the best abused and most popular man in the United States today." This remark touched off a 49-minute demonstration, 19 minutes longer than the historic bedlam that had followed William Jennings Bryan's Cross of Gold speech in 1896. 12,000 throats, including that of an ecstatic Alice Longworth, joined in roars of 4 more years, 4 more years. The enormous hall, notorious for its muffled acoustics, seemed unable to hold any more noise. Lodge's black gavel rose and fell, as if it were the only soundless thing. Toy bears bobbed and bowed to further shouts, "We want Teddy! We want Teddy!" As soon as his voice became audible, Lodge moved to forestall what looked like an incipient stampede. "That man is no friend to Theodore Roosevelt, and does not cherish his name and fame, who now, from any motive, seeks to urge him as a candidate for the great office which he has finally declined." Lodge could not help sounding oracular, but his reproof calmed the convention for the rest of the session. Joseph Buckland Bishop, the professional journalist, sycophant, and anti-Semite, whom Roosevelt had appointed secretary of the Panama Canal Commission, happened to be in Washington the following morning. He visited the executive office around 11 o'clock and found the president in the midst of yet another attempt to control fanatic third-termers in Chicago. Roosevelt never minded being observed at work, so Bishop stayed to watch and record as telegrams flashed back and forth. The action in Chicago seemed to be off the floor, while speakers began to drone the nominations of Taft and his 6 rivals, Knox, Fairbanks, Foraker, Cannon, La Follette, and Hughes. Private messages urged Roosevelt to issue another disclaimer, lest he be added to the list. He saw no reason for a man of honor to repeat himself, but was worried enough to ask for advice. Bishop persuaded him that the precautionary letter he had already issued was explicit enough. At 1:30, the president took lunch on the South Portico with Edith, Ethel, and Quentin. Bishop and another guest joined them. The grounds were already lush with premature summer, after the loveliest spring Roosevelt could recall in Washington. Only the linden trees remained in scented bloom. 900 contentious Republicans, determining who might sit here in a year's time, could have been 1,000,000 miles away, except for further telegrams of appeal and further, increasingly annoyed, presidential refusals. Bishop remained at the White House until around 4 o'clock, then crossed over to the War Department to see his boss. Taft sat calmly with Mrs. Taft, not so calm, while Taffy kept scuttling in from an anteroom with slips from Chicago. Each arrived promptly enough to describe the progress of the speeches, almost cheer by cheer. When at last Taft's name was announced, the telegrams tabulated the loudness and length of the ensuing ovation. "I only want it to last more than 49 minutes," Helen Taft said. She was denied her wish. The demonstration was over in less than half an hour. Oratory resumed for other candidates. Then, during a tribute to La Follette, the President of the United States was mentioned. Taffy came in with a wire saying that the convention had exploded. Senator Lodge was trying and failing to restore order. A huge American flag with Roosevelt's face on it had been unfurled on the platform. Mrs. Taft turned white and sat in silence. Taft tapped the arm of his chair, whistling softly. Further wires reported that the flag was being circulated round the floor, amid even greater uproar. But Lodge, determined to restore order, was proceeding with the roll call of states. After about 22 minutes, the hubbub abated, Georgia's declaration was heard, and the convention calmed. By 5:22 p.m., the delegates had registered their choice. Taft was nominated for President of the United States by a vote of 702-68 for Knox, 67 for Hughes, 58 for Cannon, 40 for Fairbanks, 25 for La Follette, and a paltry 16 for Foraker. By motion of Senator Penrose, the nomination was made unanimous, and the color returned to Helen Taft's high cheekbones. Afterward, when Congressman James S. Sherman of New York had been announced for vice president, there was the usual sotto voce recriminations among those cheated of glory. Charles Evans Hughes huffed, through his wealth of beard, that he had gotten a 2 a.m. telegram from a White House intermediary asking him in the names of both Roosevelt and Taft to accept the vice presidential nomination, along with a substantial cash bonus. He had, of course, refused. La Follette complained about the president's secret manipulation of the entire proceedings. No administration in the history of this government ever gave a more flagrant example of political control of delegates than was brazenly flaunted in the face of the public at the convention of 1908. La Follette was especially disturbed by Taft's choice of Sonny Jim Sherman, a big, bluff conservative widely seen as a stooge for Speaker Cannon. All observers were agreed, however, that the Republican ticket, at £500 and counting, was the heaviest package ever offered to American voters. "There is a little hole in my stomach," Q remarked to his father on the day after the convention, "when I think of leaving the White House." Roosevelt maintained a cheerful attitude over Taft's huge win, but when writing to intimates, such as Nanny Lodge, he could not avoid imparting a similar wistfulness. 4 more years had been so urgently, so almost compellingly offered him, not once but day after day, years in which he could without doubt accomplish the most far-reaching reforms since Reconstruction. Declining that opportunity had, as always with him, been a matter of moral compulsion. It was absolutely necessary that any stampede for me should be prevented, and that I should not be nominated. If I had accepted, my power for useful service would have forever been lessened, because nothing could have prevented the wide diffusion of the impression that I had not really meant what I had said, that my actions did not really square with the highest and finest code of ethics. And if there is any value whatever in my career, as far as my countrymen are concerned, it consists in their belief that I have been both an efficient public man and at the same time a disinterested public servant. Ray Stannard Baker stopped by to see the president that evening and found him in a rare, reflective mood. "Well, I'm through now. I've done my work." They talked until midnight. Baker suggested that the American people might not be through with him, and might be clamoring for his return to the White House in 4 years' time. "No, revolutions don't go backwards," Roosevelt said. He seemed tired, and his voice had a note of sad finality. "New issues are coming up. I see them. People are going to discuss economic issues more and more, the tariff, currency, banks. They are hard questions, and I am not deeply interested in them. My problems are moral problems, and my teaching has been plain morality." He stayed in Washington only long enough to accept Taft's resignation as Secretary of War, along with his profuse thanks and vows of obligation. They agreed that Luke Wright, a former ambassador to Japan and co-author of the Gentlemen's Agreement, should be given charge of the War Department. As to other members of the cabinet, Taft said, in the flood of his gratitude, that he saw no reason why they should not continue to serve if he was elected president. The president, delighted, relayed this information to all concerned. "He and I view public questions exactly alike," he wrote George Otto Trevelyan. "In fact, I think it is very rare that two public men have ever been so much at one in all the essentials of their public beliefs." On 20 June, he left town for Oyster Bay. Taft headed in the opposite direction to work on his acceptance speech in Hot Springs, Virginia. 4 days later, Grover Cleveland died. On 10 July, delegates at the Democratic National Convention in Denver, Colorado, nominated William Jennings Bryan for president. While doing so, they proved that their lungs were more leathery than those of Roosevelt's puny clique in Chicago, as they cheered the commoner for 1 hour and 28 minutes. Edith was not impressed. She had met Bryan at the governor's conference and decided that American voters had been right in rejecting him for the presidency twice already. "A trifle too fat and oily for the fastidious," she wrote her sister-in-law. Oily or not, Bryan was by no means unattractive to voters. He was an orator of legendary eloquence, unlike Taft, whose platform manner was awkward and gaffe-prone. The Grand Army of the Republic had not appreciated his reminder on Memorial Day that General Grant had had a drinking problem. Bryan, a genuine man of the people, was able to empathize with his audiences one-on-one, whereas Taft, the Judge Monquet, always sounded as if he was handing down majority opinions. Democratic campaign planners felt that Taft's biggest asset, his presidential backing, had counted more at the Republican convention than it would on Election Day. By then, Roosevelt would be, ideologically, a spent force, and unless Taft built a big new political personality for himself, voters might well decide that 12 years of Republican continuity were enough. Bryan, besides, had already had plenty of experience in leading his own party. Taft's behavior, after drafting his acceptance speech, indicated a certain lack of confidence after years of submitting to Roosevelt's will. Instead of heading straight home to Cincinnati to confer with his family and advisors, he took a detour to Oyster Bay, disastrously announcing that he needed the president's judgment and criticism. Roosevelt received him at Sagamore Hill on 24 July, made a few changes to the speech, wished him well, and sent him on his way. As Taft headed west, another visitor came to spend a few nights with the Roosevelts, en famille, accompanied by Assistant Treasury Secretary Beckman Winthrop. Captain Archibald Butt, he of the glittering, much-befrogged soldierly presence at the Conservation Conference, had with astonishing speed become the President's closest companion. Other military and naval aides had come and gone at the Roosevelt White House, among them an extraordinarily handsome West Pointer named Douglas MacArthur, but Archie combined personal charm and professional efficiency to such a degree that he was already indispensable. Large, strong, plumpish, and always beautifully turned out, whether in dress blue or mufti, he was 42 years old, unmarried, and devoted to his widowed mother, to whom he wrote almost daily. As a youth, he had been the Washington correspondent of a small group of Southern newspapers, and shown a distinct gift for social reporting. He had carried his writing habit into the Army, with vague thoughts of one day collecting and publishing extracts from his letters for publication. To such a natural scribe, appointment to the Roosevelt White House was a privilege worthy of Saint-Simon. Mrs. Butt, a Georgian lady of unreconstructed views, was finding that her son was the best-informed gossip in the United States.